Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Now, the sponsors of this bill, the House bill in Mississippi, said we're doing it because we have new justices. The newest ban that Mississippi has put in place, the 6-week ban, the Senate sponsor said, we're doing it because we have new justices on the Supreme Court. Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts? I don't see how it is possible.
That's U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor speaking during oral argument yesterday for the case Dobbs v. Jackson. She was not the only progressive on the court to raise the question of, well, the court's legitimacy. But that's not really an argument for Roe, is it? It's more of, well, in my opinion, an attempt to spook the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court into joining their dissent in what might be and looks like it will be a divided court on the issue of whether Roe and Casey stand. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Thursday afternoon, the 2nd of December. We're going to analyze Supreme Court oral argument in Dobbs v. Jackson. Joining us to do so, Hadley Arkus. He's Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence and American Institutions at Amherst College, founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. He's architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, author of several books, including Natural Rights and the Right to Choose, and a forthcoming publication, Mere Natural Law. Also, a recent column for First Things titled Takeaways from Oral Argument in Dobbs. Dr. Arkus, welcome back.
Oh, thanks. It's so good to hear your voice again, Todd. I just realize it's been a long while since I talk with you. But thanks for having me on.
I understand that you have a past relationship with the Mississippi Solicitor General, Scott Stewart. What can you tell us?
Oh, he's a terrific student of mine. And we're very close. He took the main course with me about First Things or political obligations where the issue of abortion is dealt with at length. And I drove back to Princeton when he graduated in order to be there at commencement and have lunch with him and his family. And he went later clerked for my friend Samuel Alito. And he knows the arguments. He knows all the arguments. He knows the substantive arguments. But Scott, making the argument, was apparently constrained to speak within the established grooves of conservative jurisprudence where the argument has been, we can't say anything about the substance of the argument, about the justification for taking lives of the unborn. All we want to say is that abortion is nowhere contained in the text of the Constitution. Therefore, federal judges have no ground in which to invoke any rights springing from the Constitution. But of course, as my friend Jerry Bradley pointed out, the federal government had many reasons to deal with abortion before that case. It could deal with abortion in military outposts, diplomatic outposts abroad, abortion in the District of Columbia. And by the way, marriage was not mentioned in the Constitution as a subject for the federal government, but yet that didn't bar the court from striking down the laws that barred marriage across racial lines back in 1967. So this is a curious grounds. What it does is, we see the conservatives invoking text, structure, and history. And the appeal to history is an appeal to those principles long anchored in our tradition. And why do they do that? They do that for the sake of avoiding the question of whether those principles, as we find them, are true and defensible. That is a trickier moral question for some of these people. And so they simply want to say, well, it's long established. Well, no, slavery was long established. There are many things. Segregation was long established. So you find ourselves, in fact, this we get from the other side, the liberal side. We say, well, marriage, as we've known it, a man and a woman with a legal commitment has known this for thousands of years. And from the left, we get people invoking that line from Justice Holmes saying, you must be able to say something more about a law than to say it's been around since Henry IV. Okay. Now, that's a lie, but we can't seem to use it now on the question of abortion. It's been around 49 years. And in fact, the meaning of the case is not as settled as people think. You know, you've been following me on the Born Alive Act to see if we could protect the life of the child who survives the abortion. You remember there's a federal judge who told us we couldn't do that, which is why we came forth with that bill to sort of can we protect the child who survived? Can we say that that child marked for an abortion has a claim to the protection of the law and say that, and then they say later, well, then it must have a standing, have some intrinsic significance that doesn't depend on whether anyone wants her. We came forth with that bill just to make a critical point, but yet it's never arisen in the confirmation hearings for judges. For somebody to ask, if we tried to get people to ask Sonia Sotomayor, or even Eleni Kagan, saying, look, the man who appointed you, Barack Obama, thought that this move to protect the child surviving an abortion to be unconstitutional, which is to say he doesn't think it's compatible with Roe versus Wade. Do you think that Roe versus Wade actually entails the right to kill a child born alive who survives an abortion? That question deserves to be asked. And if it is still a plausible question to ask, it should be clear that the meaning of Roe versus Wade is not at all settled 48 years after the case. But what's amazing is that how these substantive questions don't get addressed in the argument, even in the oral argument before the highest court, containing some of our most accomplished conservative jurists. That's not the way somehow these people speak about these things. And it's now, I confess, a mystery and a moment of despair for me. Is it, why do our people think they have to talk in this way in order to present a case before the Supreme Court? I think it's to avoid casting moral judgments and leave those moral judgments to be made elsewhere. That seems to be the pattern.
How should the Solicitor General of Mississippi, Scott Stewart, have responded when Justice Thomas kind of teed it up for him and asked him whether the constitutional ground for the right to abortion rested on notions of privacy and autonomy? How should he have responded?
He should have said that any question of liberty or privacy is ever the question, well, what are you protecting and what are you sheltering? The question is, do you have a right to do, as Lincoln and Thomas Aquinas said, do you have a right to do wrong? Do you have a liberty to do wrongful things? Remember, this is James Wilson, one of our founders, responding to Blackstone years ago, Blackstone saying, we have a liberty to do mischief. And in the state of nature, and Wilson said, when did you ever have a liberty to do mischief? When did you ever have a right to do wrong? Those laws that restrain you from murdering and raping are not depriving you of anything you ever had a rightful freedom to do. So the question arises here, privacy. Privacy can't mean sheltering plans for an assassination. It can't be privacy in carrying out an unjustified killing. No assertion or claim of liberty can possibly entail a right to kill an innocent human being. So what you do is point out that autonomy and privacy simply become the first steps in explaining why my privacy, why my liberty, why my autonomy is used and being directed to things that are rightful and not wrongful. You know, at the beginning, it was very common for people to talk about liberty versus license, right? We've heard that. What was license? The misuse of liberty. The use of liberty toward a wrongful end. That question has to arise over any account of, and whenever people talk about liberty, my liberty to do what? What am I sheltering in my privacy? What am I claiming a right to do in my privacy, to hide plans for assassination, to torture a child? This matters profoundly. So the argument should be, well, these are empty moral terms. They suggest moral agents, people who are making decisions about what to do with their liberty. And, of course, it gives rise to the question whether they're using their liberty to do rightful, wrongful ends. And so the answer is these terms often evoke cannot settle any matter of consequence before you in this case. It cannot settle the question of whether you're justified or unjustified in taking the life of the small human being living for a while in this womb.
How is the idea of viability central to the Dobbs case?
Because that's finally what the court is resting on. After all these years, they had a tripart segment of first trimester, second trimester, the court saying, well, you could restrain abortion. You can't restrain abortion in the first trimester. You might restrain it later on for the sake of potential life. Not potential life. Life is there and growing. It could be potential out for your lawyer, but it's not a potential life. Okay, we have the tripartite scheme. And then, of course, the point was made that nothing in the Constitution gives rise to that tripartite scheme. The Constitution tells us that we have a right to life, liberty, and property. They don't tell us you have a right to your life but only when you're 6 months along in gestation. So what they finally settled on was the line of viability, the point at which a child can be preserved outside the womb. Of course, that line is constantly being pushed back by advances in technology and so we can protect children and babies even earlier. But the main point of it is, at the root of the matter, the argument about viability, why is it important? Because the child can survive on her own, but she can't survive on her own. And are you telling us, this is the main moral argument here, are you telling us that any one of us loses our standing, our rights, our claims, our rights as citizens, or even our human standing, when we suddenly become weaker or infirm and need the help, the care of other people? That's a bizarre claim. We certainly have enough in our moral tradition, whether in classical philosophy or the biblical tradition, to see what's wrong with it. What we used to call, in Republic with Plato, Thrasymachus, the right of the strong, the rule of the strong to have their way. Or to put it another way, as we know, might makes right. Now, people of ordinary sensibility tend naturally to recoil from that when they hear it. Do you think people have a right to beat you up if they succeed? Do you think that the people who are stronger have a right to a precise because they're stronger? Well, virtually anyone we encounter would recoil from that notion. Then the question is, how suddenly did that become a plausible argument to give primacy to have standing in our constitutional law as the ground on which we may be justified or unjustified in taking lives of children? Now, even my friends at the Wall Street Journal are astonished the other day to see that's the line they take, viability. Well, that line rests upon a non sequitur. We should all recognize why. The test of viability is a simply measure of strength, cannot simply be a measure of the claim of that child, that human being that's been human from its first moments. Now, in our ordinary sensibilities, we ask people, would say, well, the fact that the child is small, very small, our laws of homicide are virtually indifferent to the question of the size, height, age of the victim. We don't say that the killing of an older, heavier man is a more serious homicide than the killing of a child. Well, this is what we're dealing with. Once you understand that, I'm curious to be arguing about a human being. I mean, of course they're human. What else can they be? If you're dealing with, we understand we're dealing with small human beings. Well, it looks like it doesn't look exactly. Yeah, well, that's what it looks like now in its earliest stages. But that is you. That is the child. It has all the genetic equipment that will give us its height, weight, its probably its allergies, perhaps its SAT scores. There's nothing you have now that you didn't have when you were that zygote, no larger than a period at the end of the sentence. It was all there. You have nothing genetically now that you didn't have at that first moment. So I guess a long answer to the question, but it stymies me as to how so many accomplished, urbane friends, like our friends of the Wall Street Journal, could possibly take this seriously. The court was getting at it in another way. Justice Alito was asking, well, why does this make a difference if the woman has a right to rid herself of a pregnancy that she thinks will encumber her life? Why is that right lessened when the child seems to be stronger? Why is that? Why does she have the higher claim when the child is weaker? You know, this doesn't make. And on the other hand, as he suggested, if the child has a claim to the protection, well, if we recognize it's a human being with a claim to the protections that are accorded to all other human beings, then why would that small being in the womb claim our protection even at its earliest moments? So again, you see that Sam Alito is responsive to the question. He can make the moral argument, and other people must understand it. But it would be more useful if they did make the moral argument. It would be more useful if they challenge these people on the other side making the argument to defend those laws. Why should they not be compelled to explain whether they think that people lose their claim to live or their rights as soon as they become enfeebled or weaker? I mean, why should they be spared those challenging questions?
We're talking with Hadley Arkus, architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, about Supreme Court oral argument heard in Dobbs v. Jackson yesterday. When we come back, why are questions of moral substance vital to the pro-life cause, not only before the Supreme Court, but going forward, even if Roe falls?
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Advent season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Advent season, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Are you looking for Christ-focused ornaments and gifts this Advent? Ad Crucem has a wide selection of Christmons, Christmas ornaments, greeting cards, artwork, housewares, jewelry, and churchwares to boldly and beautifully proclaim the good news of Christ given for us. Put what you believe, teach, and confess on display this year. Visit adcrucem.com. That's ADCRUCEM.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're looking for a Christmas gift for a child, grandchild, or godchild ages 3 through 8, give them the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, Symbols of Salvation, The Story of Jesus' Birth. It's a new, interactive, and illustrated book showcasing the true story of Christmas in rhyme. Symbols of Salvation is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Symbols of Salvation, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month.
Memoria Press exists to promote and impart the classical heritage of the Christian West through an emphasis on the liberal arts and the great works of the Western tradition. The Memoria Press curriculum encourages the development of wisdom and virtue through the pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR22. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. memoriapress.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Hadley Arkus is our guest. We are analyzing Supreme Court oral argument in Dobbs v. Jackson. Hadley, you have recently written this. A court that sends things back to the states without saying anything on the question of moral substance is a court that will leave us with no coherent sense of what this warring argument over 50 years has really been about. So, Hadley, why are questions of moral substance vital to the pro-life cause, not only before the Supreme Court, but even if Roe should fall afterward?
Well, it's been filtered out of the language of lawyers for years. It began probably with Justice Holmes in the famous piece saying his hope was to create a system of law in which all words of moral significance can be purged altogether, to leave us a field of law nicely cleansed of any moral judgments. And I'm afraid that's been really taken over by many of our conservative friends, who say that we don't want to be results-oriented. We want to have these neutral principles that we'll respect, quite apart from the results they give us from time to time. Okay. It makes a profound difference. First of all, you can't give a coherent account, I think, of what you're doing in sending anything back to the states. I mean, we have this goes back to the argument of Roe versus Wade in 1973. We had a dramatic contrast there between the argument offered by the lawyers for Texas, showing us the development of that unborn child week by week, showing us that we have here a human being, human from its first moments, never a merely an attachment to its mother. And the laws on homicide are indifferent to the size and age of the victim. On the other hand, we have dissenters who never took up that substantive argument. So from the beginning, all they would argue is abortion is nowhere mentioned in the Constitution. This is simply raw judicial power because we took out of the hands of voters. Decisions should be left to the state. So, number one, Justice White started with a concern for the abortion that could be done for the basest of reasons, but they simply shifted, they transmuted the nature of the wrong by transmuting the nature of the victim. The victims were no longer the child, the children being dismembered or poisoned in these surgeries. The victims now were the voters in the states who were deprived of the possibility of deliberating with other citizens on the question of human life, because the court, in an arrogant move, has taken the judgment unto itself. Well, that's the argument that has stuck over the years. So Solicitor General Stewart, faced with this question, on the substantive questions, would keep sending them off by saying, well, yeah, beginning of human life, that is an interesting, baffling question. That should be left in the hands of voters to decide. Well, it would have made a profound difference in Roe versus Wade if the argument was the lawyers from Texas did their serious work. They showed us why the laws were warranted in casting their protection over unborn children. They made a compelling case to show us why it was justified. If the dissenters had picked up that line, they would have picked up the sense of what this whole matter was truly about, not simply an argument over lines of jurisdiction of who had the authority to make this decision. So now let's bring it up to the current day. Let's say we're sending it back to the states. Does it make a difference if we say, look, this is a matter of gravity. You must understand. This is a matter of taking innocent life. We're turning this matter to you in the states for you to reckon how grave you consider this taking of a human life. How grave is it when you set it along the whole scheme of your laws on homicide? And how do you want to treat this? You set it up in that way. Say, we invite you to tell us what you think is the justification for taking a human life. Consider doing that way, or considering then saying, we're sending it back to you because 49 years ago, God, we made a serious mistake figuring out the lines of jurisdiction. You see the difference? It doesn't tell us anything.
What did we hear yesterday regarding precedent or that term of art, stare decisis?
A lot of confusion over it. I'd say a Holmesian understanding of stare decisis, that is, we're trying to make a prediction of what judges are likely to do, an expectation that we honor this decision as it comes down, as the question is posed in cases coming along later. We respect the old rule. Now, the problem is they know there have been cases in which old rules of decision were overturned. Most notably, of course, Brown versus Board of Education on racial segregation, overturning the decision in Plessy versus Ferguson. Justice Kennedy said in case years ago that, well, so many women have relied on the expectation that abortion will be there for them. Well, Justice Alito pointed out, well, so many people had a reliance interest on segregation. Schools were built, open conventions and social policies and theaters and buses were built upon this expectation of that the rule in Plessy versus Ferguson will be absorbed. So they keep coming back to say, well, what are the grounds on which we may overturn this decision? And finally, it's Justice Alito who said, quite apart from how long ago it was, how recent it was, what if you hold that the decision was egregiously wrong, why would they not be warranted in overturning it? And of course, he wasn't inviting the lawyer on the other side to engage them in the question of whether Roe was egregiously wrong, whether she could explain why it was justified to take the life of an innocent human being, or why it was justified for someone to claim the right to kill a child of whom as it served merely her own interest. He didn't draw them out and just challenging them on that point. He simply planted the notion that, let's say, if it were egregiously wrong, then we should have no hesitation in overturning it. And I think that Justice Scalia would have said the same thing. But the question is, we still don't know, why do our friends think it was egregiously wrong. And Scalia's explanation is egregiously wrong because the Supreme Court has no authority to deal with this. This matter must go back to the states, where people can make what he called value judgments on how much value they're willing to impute to human life. Value judgments, as you remember, Todd, value judgments is a term that came into play with Nietzsche and Max Weber at the turn of the previous century. People started using value judgments when they stopped speaking about moral truths. So they spoke instead of those things that have value because we impart value to them. So the curious thing, what Scalia and others were doing is inviting the states to enter a value judgment on whether this was a human life. Lincoln famously said, whether a slave is right or wrong depends on whether the black man is a man. If he is a man, then he too has a right to be governed with his own consent. And Professor Harry Jaffa, following up on that, said, the question of whether the black man is a black man cannot be a value judgment. That is, would we put that question out to the separate states and say, how many of you really consider the black man as a human being? How many of you attach value to treating the black man as a human being? Well, I've said, it makes as much sense, or want of sense, to say that we're going to put back in the states the question of how much it pleases you to attach value to that child in the womb, whether you're willing to regard the child in the womb as a human being. That is not a question for value judgments. It is a question anchored in a necessary truth. So I think even if some of our friends on the court say that it was egregiously wrong, they're still not explaining to us the grounds on which it was egregiously wrong. But here you're just getting another reflection of what conservatives have come to understand is of the rule of law. We're trying to reduce law to certain neutral principles so that we leave the moral judgments as much as possible in the hands of the American people.
Hadley Arkus is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence and American Institutions at Amherst College. We're analyzing Supreme Court oral argument in Dobbs v. Jackson. On the other side, he says that Justice Sonia Sotomayor outdid herself yesterday. We'll find out how next. Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's Life Ministry is thousands of people sharing Christ's love and mercy and giving witness to our Lord's creation of life, His design for marriage and the family, and the God-given value of all human life from conception to natural death. Working with many partners, LCMS Life Ministry sponsors human care efforts that meet the needs of body and soul and provides resources and educational events for all ages. To learn more, email lifeministry@lcms.org and visit lcms.org/life.
Do you want your neighbors and community to see what you're celebrating this Christmas season? Why not display an outdoor nativity in front of your home or your church? It's a great way to show others what Christmas is all about, the birth of our Savior Jesus Christ. Check out the Outdoor Nativity Store at OutdoorNativityStore.com. Durable, affordable, and American-made nativities, OutdoorNativityStore.com. OutdoorNativityStore.com.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.
Hadley Arkus, architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, is our guest. Oral argument in Dobbs v. Jackson is our topic. I'm Todd Wilkin, your link to issues, etc. You can help us defend life from beginning to end by making a year-end tax-deductible donation to support this worldwide outreach of issues, etc. No gift is too small. You can contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues, etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening and thanks for keeping Issues, etc. in mind at the end of 2021. Hadley, you say that Justice Sonia Sotomayor outdid herself yesterday. How so?
Well, a whole list of fallacies. She's also taken an awful political line that's saying it was... some of you say that the word has been said that there are now six conservative judges. This is political. Well, of course, her own nomination to the court was highly political. Why would she have been chosen, this woman of no formidable skills? Why was she elevated? Why are these decisions resisted by the court, these nominations resisted, except for the grossest political motives, the plainest? But she went, I think, a number of just solace, just things are just so plainly wrong. She said that Robbery versus Madison established that the court had the sole final authority to make judgments on the Constitution. Well, the Chief Justice Marshall in Robbery versus Madison never said anything like that. He said that the judges had an obligation to consider whether any measure coming before them, a statute to be judged, whether they had to measure that statute against the fundamental law, of the Constitution, the laws that tell us how we get laws. Well, he didn't claim anything there that would not be claimed, no obligation that would not flow to any other officer in the government. If a president had before him a bill conscripting into the military services over members of a minority race, would he simply be confined to the question of utility? Would this measure work? Or would he be required no less than any judge to measure the question of whether this measure coming under his hand was consistent with the Constitution? Marshall never claimed the judges had the sole responsibility for making those judgments. They certainly never claimed they were the final. In fact, we have plenty of evidence to show that the court is these are not final judgments, that the court makes a decision and the political branches respond, and sometimes the courts modify the decisions. Point is, there is no place of a final decision. It's more accurate to say our constitutional law involves an ongoing conversation among the branches. But one of the other real zingers of hers is when she said that the question about fetal pain, because the statute in Mississippi sought to bar abortions at the time where fetuses feel pain, and they cast it 15 weeks, which was very conservative estimate. She offered this judgment as though we're established fact that fetuses cannot feel pain in the womb for whatever, 20 weeks or so. But as I said in my piece, that argument was exploded 36 years ago in the hearings of the Judiciary Committee of the Senate, hearings on fetal pain, and my old dear friend Daniel Robinson, who was a leading figure of the neural sciences, came in to say, well, look, we have enough to know that pain can be suffered even without a cortex. We've had examples of people losing half their cortex. Corticized patients, as he said, who still feel pain. Pain is a reflexive matter. You don't respond to it with syllogisms and arguments. It's something that the most primitive feelings, and even beings without much mental power, can show the response to it. They pull away from a hot iron. You're not giving arguments. You're engaging in a reflex. And what he shows is that he made in that hearing, this is Daniel Robinson, he made in that hearing one doctor from Yale back away from the claim that fetuses cannot feel pain before 12 weeks. Just can't be so. But Sotomayor was offering this as though it were just a settled fact. So she continues in a rare vein of somebody who, so you can advance to a high position. Oh, and especially also that strange argument that the beginning of life is a religious question. Look, years ago, the Senate Committee on the Judiciary took a survey of all the leading books on gynecology and embryology, and there's no trace of dissent in any of those books on the question when human life began. It begins with the mating of a male and female gamete to form a distinct human being, genetically separate from either one, distinct from either one. And in fact, we did another survey about 10, 12 years ago, same books, nothing has been altered. The question of when does human life begin? The answer is it begins at conception, when you have the advent of that unique being, which, as I say, may be no larger than the period at the end of a sentence. That's the beginning. Everything else from that is a matter of the embryo and the nascent life just growing, getting more articulated, powering it, integrating its own growth as an animating living force. Now, as we say, look, how can you be arguing over whether it's a life? If there's nothing growing in the womb, then abortion is no more indicated, as they say, than a tonsillectomy. But if it is living, we cannot be in any doubt about its species. So here is sort of this cliche is so old, and you say, well, how can she continue with this? And how many? But when she raised it, Scott Stewart simply said, well, that's a baffling question, and that's why we leave it to people in the separate states to argue about. No, that is not a question we leave to people in the separate states to argue about. That must be a predicate, a part of, if we send the matter back to the states, that must be a predicate. We're not sending this matter to you to decide when human life begins. That is a question already well established, and it's anchored in inescapable truth. So what you see is, but on the other hand, you know, I can see where the matter's been complicated, because in the arguments over religious freedom, we have some of our friends coming in, Mr. Green in Hobby Lobby, who was compelled under Obamacare to cover medical care and abortion, coming in and said he simply believed, as a matter of religious belief, that life began at conception. In other words, for the sake of making his claim to religious freedom, he converted the inescapable truth to matter simply into a personal belief. So our own people have been feeding that notion that this is a religious matter. But still, we should have dissolved that cliche and swept it away long ago.
When Sotomayor attempted to frame the question of when life begins as a matter outside the court's purview because it's a religious question, what did you make of Stewart's response to Sotomayor's assertion?
Well, that, as I said, he simply said, that's an interesting, baffling question. People should be free to argue about it in the state. In other words, instead of responding with the inescapable truth of the matter, instead of responding with the secular force, the secular understanding contained in the medical books on embryology, instead of responding to that, he converted it into the usual argument of conservative jurisprudence. We're not making moral judgments on these things. We're simply sending the matters back to the states, where people then may make their moral judgment. We'll call them value judgments on these matters. In other words, he's playing by the script. I mean, Scott is a wonderful student of mine, and what you see is that as he moves into this profession, and he sees himself compelled to make the kinds of arguments that judges affect to understand or affect to regard as the grounds on which they will make their own judgments. You say, well, how has this, we could ask, how has this settled? I'm in a slight despair over this in a state of what, how has this settled in among some of our most accomplished men in the law, that this is the way they talk about this matter when they're in courts. This is not the way they talk about this matter when they're in with home with friends. There they can talk about the substantive issues. Why is it that they think that once they put the robes on and once they're in a court, that language of moral substance must vanish or disappear. That is one of the things of yesterday that leaves me in the kind of muted despair. Now, it still could come out the right way. I think my whole hunch is that it will come out the right way. There'll be some kind of protection for the life in the womb, that they'll probably sustain that law. They may even summon the nerve to say this is all not coherent if we keep Roe versus Wade. But on the other hand, what they might do is, one possibility they could do it, is just say, follow the line of Justice White from years ago, they could say, well, there is this minimal right that almost everybody understands. The right to have an abortion when the life of the mother is in danger. That situation these days is exceedingly rare. But it's the thing that most people in the country understand. I can imagine the court coming back and saying, sure, we'll preserve Roe versus Wade and the right to an abortion, but in a much more scaled-down version, scaled down now to that minimal level where most people in the country would accept it. And I could see, you know, I see there was a survey the other day saying that 28% of people do not think Roe versus Wade should be. One reason they don't is they don't know what's in Roe versus Wade. They don't know that under Roe versus Wade you could have an abortion right through the end of the pregnancy, perhaps, and even kill the child when it comes out. Most people don't know this. But if there are people who think, well, there must be, they don't want to see Roe versus Wade dislodged entirely, one path for the judges would be, I think, to take what we might call the low door under the wall, to sort of scoop away just about everything bad that has been added to the law since Roe versus Wade. Sweep away requirements of informed consent, sweep away schemes of circumventing the parents for minors, sweep away all that stuff and simply preserve your right to an abortion when your life may be in danger and tell the public, we haven't overthrown it. It is still there, but it's a scale much more muted now, scaled back, with most of its evils removed. Well, perhaps they could possibly do it that way. For all we know, it could have a more reassuring effect on the public. My own hunch is that John Roberts, the Chief Justice, will try to have a more limited decision. He may want to say that, well, look, we've settled on viability, but that has no real meaning. It's just a convenient marker. So if we can settle on viability, why would we just settle on 15 weeks so people have to make up their minds in 15 weeks? And for all we know, our friends in the Wall Street Journal, other people say, all right, that seems sensible. We'll settle for that. People, as we've seen, people don't think very deeply on this question or very reflectively. So that could be what arises from this. Or perhaps they go the rest of the way and overturn Roe altogether. But the melancholy report I guess I'm offering you today is, even if they do that, we're not clear they could send it back to the states with any adequate sense of the moral gravity of what they're sending it back to the states, sending it back without establishing the predicate that we're dealing inescapably with a human life. We're not sending back the question for you of when you think that human life begins. We're sending it back with the sense there's something involved, grave involved, in the taking of an innocent human life, and we're turning this back to you to see how you deliberate about how serious you take the killing of a child in the womb. It makes a profound difference as the way we send it back.
Hadley Arkus is our guest. We're analyzing the Supreme Court oral argument in Dobbs v. Jackson. At one point, all three progressive justices, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, worried out loud about the political consequences of overturning Roe. We'll talk about it next. With 5 weeks left in 2021, we need $192,000 to cover our expenses for the year. Please make a year-end tax-deductible gift to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. You can contribute by check, make your check payable to Issues Etc., and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of Issues Etc. at the end of the year.
For your next family vacation, consider our beach house. A charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Truth, freedom, and vocation are the pillars of a Concordia University Chicago education. Through them, we form our students for lives of influence and service for the common good. This is the education American society needs right now. I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth, freedom, and vocation to become the pillars of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
For nearly 140 years, the Lutheran Witness has taught the faith, defended it against error, and shown forth the great treasures of the Lutheran Church and biblical doctrine. We're continuing this legacy by publishing issues and articles that help you see the world from a Lutheran perspective and that teach biblical doctrine and show forth the treasures of God's Word. Visit our website to learn more and how to subscribe, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Dr. Hadley Arkus is our guest. He's founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and American Founding and Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence and American Institutions at Amherst College. We're talking about Supreme Court oral argument in Dobbs v. Jackson. Hadley, at one point during this two-hour session, all three progressive justices, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, worried out loud about the political consequences of overturning Roe and Casey for the court. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's just a way of intimidating the court to say that this will be understood as a wrongful decision, and they'll move on to pack the court to overturn this decision. It is curious if when you're overturning something they want, then it represents a grave threat to the institution of the court. See. But they're not made to defend the position of why you think this decision was justified in the first place. They're giving us an account of what their friends outside the court are willing to do, that whatever happens here, if the court scales a board, scales Roe versus Wade back, whether it overrules it outright or scales it back, it's going to be treated as the overruling of Roe. It's likely to set off a firestorm in the country, even so. And in which case, the judges may decide, look, we're going to get a firestorm no matter what we do. But this is simply people are losing the argument. And it's a last-ditch effort to say, aha, there'll be political repercussions, which is to say, our friends are going to be on the rampage, stirring up riots, claiming deprivation, million women marches, riots in the street, to show you that there are grave political consequences for overturning something that many people in the country have come to rely upon as an anchoring truth necessary to their personal privacy, in the way, so some people regarded their right to an abortion is far more important as an anchoring ground of my personal freedom than the right to religious freedom or the right to speech, the right to association. That's a measure of where we are in the country. It's a fine thing for the. You can see the court maybe to have this in mind as it tries to step deftly around this issue to see if it can, in fact, make a plausible decision while at the same time allaying the forces that are threatened to arise. My hunch is that they come forth with a pretty plausible decision, that decision will carry in itself, and that they may simply empower the pro-lifers in the country to be firmed up and animated in making their argument, too.
Did Chief Justice Roberts give us any idea of his take on the case during argument yesterday?
Well, a couple of things. He said, on this matter of viability, he said, well, what is it? And they said, it's a time when the child can survive outside the womb. And he said, all you've done is given us a definition of viability, which is to say, you haven't told us why that line should make any moral difference in whether we are justified in giving a license to people to destroy a child up to the time of life of viability, or whether we're justified in restraining the killing of the child after viability. Simply telling us what it is does not give us any ground for a moral judgment here. It has no moral significance or juridical significance then. And so what he was saying is, okay, he was calling that into question. But at the same time, as I just said a moment ago, you think he's looking for some very limited way of sustaining the law in Mississippi so he doesn't look as though he's overturning Roe versus Wade. But my hunch is this, that if five conservative judges, apart from John Roberts, managed to come together in a willingness even to overturn Roe versus Wade, John Roberts will provide the sixth vote. He would not, as Chief Justice, he would not, at least seen from what he's done in the past, he would not allow a momentous decision of that kind to be carried only on the slimmest margin of 5-4. Because that kind of outcome will invite all kinds of recriminations and supercharge the people who want to call into question, pack the courts, overturn it. It would seem far harder to overturn a court that a judgment that has the vote of a 2-1, 6-3 judgment. So my hunch is if they did find five votes to overturn Roe versus Wade, John Roberts would provide the sixth vote for the sake of securing it. But in that case, he would probably give himself, as if the Chief Justice could assign the writing of the opinions, he would probably assign to himself the task of writing the opinion. And if he does, he will try to cast it in a far more limited way.
What were the high and low points for the U.S. government's argument there, not Mississippi's, but the Solicitor General of the United States?
I found no high point. I found no high point, because there's nothing. All you can argue is that this has somehow become important for women. What's become important for women is the freedom to destroy an innocent life as it suits their convenience or it suits their interest. Again, a proposition that even liberals will recoil from if we put the question to them, do you think you have a right to kill another human being if that advances your interests? So does it advance your interests? No. Her argument was simply predicated on the notion that here's viability, here is the right to women, you're doing something very serious. Again, it's overruling, you're doing something very serious, you're calling the court into question when you overrule something so well settled. It's again, the same morally empty arguments we've seen over the years. And they're morally empty because they simply can't carry the moral argument. They can't carry the argument of explaining why this child in the womb is anything less than human, and it's nothing less than human than the kinds of reasons we're obliged to bring forth to justify the taking of this life must be in the same plane as the justifications we are compelled to bring forth in justifying the taking of any other human life. If the new child will raise anxiety in the family, so may the addition of aged parents to the household. So that's the point. They can't get around that central construction of the problem, the moral dimensions of the problem cast in those terms. What is the principal ground on which this child is anything less than a human being? It is a human being, then how do you justify the taking of this innocent? Those questions have been nicely submerged. They've been overridden by the cliches, the mindless cliches that have simply been settled, and they've been settled so long, they've become so familiar to us that we may take them as familiar sounds in our political life, rather like some of the commercials that have embedded themselves as lasting memories in our ears.
Hadley Arkus is Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence and American Institutions at Amherst College. He's founder and director of the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights and the American Founding, architect of the Born Alive Infants Protection Act, author of several books, including Natural Rights and the Right to Choose, and a forthcoming publication, Mirror Natural Law, and a recent column for First Things titled Takeaways from Oral Argument in Dobbs. You can read this column and purchase Hadley's books at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Hadley, thank you very much.
Oh, Todd, thank you. You're a terrific interviewer. Thanks. You let me talk too much.
Friday on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris about the socialist attack on the family, and we'll discuss a new study showing single Americans want to get married but don't like their prospects. Our guest will be Tim Gagline of Focus on the Family. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.